Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our Vatican Weekend English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading prepared by Jill Bevilacqua. And a marriage lifeline. We find out about a special church-sponsored program that helps couples whose marriage is heading for the rocks. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The Pharisees went off and began to plot how they might trap Jesus in speech. They sent their disciples to him, accompanied by Herodian sympathizers, who said, "Teacher, we know you are a truthful man and teach God's way sincerely. You court no one's favor and do not act out of human respect. Give us your opinion, then, in this case. Is it lawful to pay tax to the emperor or not?" Jesus recognized their bad faith and said to them, "Why are you trying to trip me up, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." When they handed him a small Roman coin, he asked them, "Whose head is this and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. At that he said to them, "Then give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but give to God what is God's."
The episode of today's Gospel is one of the most quoted of all the famous episodes of our Lord's public life. The Pharisees, together with the scribes and chief priests, have realized that the parables Jesus has told are aimed at them. But much as they long to lay hands on him, their fear of the people holds them back for the moment. So they go off and plot how to trap him in what he says. But instead of confronting him themselves, they sent him their disciples, and with them Herodian sympathizers. The Herodians were not a religious party, but politically minded men who wanted the kingdom of Herod the Great restored to his son Herod Antipas. But they, unlike the Pharisees, who were fanatically nationalistic, bowed to Roman authority. They were useful then, on this occasion, to pose such a question as the lawfulness of paying tax to the emperor. On another occasion, too, the Pharisees had consulted with the Herodians how they might destroy him. It was when he healed the man with the withered hand on the Sabbath. As it took place in Galilee, which was Herod's territory, the Pharisees could not go ahead and destroy Jesus without the cooperation of the Herod party. They were convenient allies then. From my father's old Shorter Oxford Dictionary, I see that in Middle English, the term Herodian was one of reproach. "They jump with Caesar, like the Herodians," runs a quotation of 1592. Frank Sheed describes them bluntly as hecklers, and this they certainly were. St. Luke introduces this episode immediately after the parable of the wicked husbandmen of the vineyard. He writes,
"They realized that this parable was aimed at them, so they waited their opportunity and sent agents to pose as men devoted to the law and to fasten on something he might say and so enable them to hand him over to the jurisdiction and authority of the governor."
The hecklers begin, as one writer puts it, with a loaded compliment.
"We know you are a truthful man and teach God's way sincerely. You court no one's favour and do not act out of human respect."
And then came the insidious question, was it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? The tribute, or tax, had to be paid by every subject of the Roman Empire. But the Jews paid it very unwillingly, Apart from the natural human dislike of paying taxes, for them it was an odious sign of subjection to a foreign power, and pagan at that. It also meant calling into question the acknowledgement of Yahweh as the only sovereign. If he were to say yes, Jesus would be accused of betraying the Jewish people. If no, he could be handed over to Pontius Pilate and put to death. Our Lord avoided the trap, but asked to see a coin which was used for the tax. They showed him a silver coin with the image of the Emperor Tiberius, and the words, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus. And to his question, whose head is this and whose inscription, they could not but answer, Caesar's. And with his answer, Jesus silenced them.
There are two elements here, an immediate element and a profounder. Caesar was the ruler, hated but legitimate, of Palestine. Even the Pharisees had asked for a Roman procurator instead of the murderous Archelaus. That was the answer to the question actually asked. But the words go far deeper. Caesar has powers, of course. He can take what he wants. But now we hear from the words of the man who was God that Caesar has rights. Whatever the civil authority requires for the proper conduct of society, to that it has a right. Christ says so. In the truest sense, therefore, it is a divine right. And this our Lord could say just a few days before Caesar crucified him.
The stand Jesus took, comments a modern Bible scholar, helped to direct the early Christian communities not to take up anarchical positions, as we read in St. Paul's letter to the Romans.
You must obey the governing authorities. Since all government comes from God, the civil authorities were appointed by God. And so anyone who resists authority is rebelling against God's decision, and such an act is bound to be punished. If you want to live without being afraid of authority, you must live honestly, and authority may even honor you. The state is there to serve God for your benefit. The authorities are there to serve God. You must obey, therefore, not only because you are afraid of being punished, but also for conscience' sake. This is also the reason why you must pay taxes, since all government officials are God's officers. They serve God by collecting taxes. Pay every government official what he has a right to ask, whether it be direct tax or indirect, fear or honor.
When I read this gospel, however, my mind went immediately to another episode, also regarding the payment of a tribute or tax, and to a painting considered one of the greatest masterpieces of all time. In the year 1424, a young man of 22 was commissioned by a certain Brancacci to decorate part of a private chapel in the Church of the Carmine in Florence. Though his name was Tommaso, or Thomas, he has always been known as Masaccio, or Slovenly Tom, for his careless way of dressing and his lack of interest in money or possessions. The subject of the painting was to be incidents in the life of St. Peter, including the finding of the tribute money, which, comments one writer, was an unemotional scene hitherto rarely depicted. The incident took place in Capernaum, where Jesus and Peter arrived together after the Transfiguration, and before our Lord's definitive departure for Judea. The only evangelist to record it is Matthew, hardly surprisingly, for as a former tax collector, he was particularly up in financial and tax matters, writes Piero Bargellini.
Because of his old profession, he knew very well that 2 months before the Passover, the collection would begin in every community in Palestine of the tax that every Israelite over 20 had to pay towards temple worship.
The tax originated in the Law of Moses, which provided that every adult male should make a small payment each year for the building of the tabernacle for the Ark of the Covenant. In time, it became a contribution to what has been described as the enormous expenses of the daily sacrifice and other offices in the temple at Jerusalem. The Jerusalem Bible, in the Book of Exodus, refers to it as a poll tax, payable when a census was made.
Everyone subject to the census must pay half a shekel, and this half shekel shall be set aside for Yahweh, the ransom for your lives.
In the Greek text of the New Testament, scholars tell us, the word didrachma is used, that is, 2 drachmae. But the tax was paid in Hebrew currency, which, we're told, is why there were money changers in the temple. The fact that Jesus paid the tax both for himself and for Peter, writes Sheed, looks as though he were definitely emphasizing a special relationship between himself and Peter, who was to be head of the church upon earth after Christ. And the painting by Masaccio? It's a fresco cycle in 3 parts. In the centre, the tax man is demanding payment of the poll tax from our Lord and the Apostles. Jesus turns to Peter and tells him to find the coin in the mouth of the fish. On the left, in the background, Peter is bending down to catch the fish. On the right, in the foreground, Peter, with an air of mingled dignity and contempt, writes one critic, is handing the coin to the tax collector. Masaccio died at the age of 27. But, we read, in his short life, he brought about a revolution in the dramatic and realistic representation of biblical events. He concentrated on the drama of the situation. The gestures and groupings of the figures were used to describe the action. Giorgio Vasari, in his Lives of the Artists, points out that Masaccio himself appears as one of the apostles.
In a self-portrait, which Masaccio executed so skillfully with the help of a mirror that it seems to breathe, we're shown the bold way in which St. Peter is questioning our Lord, and the attentiveness of the apostles as they stand in various attitudes around Christ, waiting for his decision, with such animated gestures that they look truly alive. St. Peter is especially remarkable, as he flushes with the effort he is making in bending to take the money out from the belly of the fish, and even more when he pays the tribute, where we can see his emotion as he counts the money and the greed of the man who's receiving it and is looking at it in his hand with great satisfaction.
Vasari was writing in the late 1600s, but a 20th century critic, equally enthusiastic, adds his own interpretation.
Masaccio has formed a group of potent and formidable individuals. These simple men are fit to shake a world. He has shown them in a moment in which discouragement and determination blend. The technicality threatens to check the salvation of the world. He has discriminated between the assured authority of the Christ and the wrathful energy of St. Peter. He has invested the majestic forms with massive draperies, grandly disposed in simple folds. He has given even the tax gatherer the grace of a Roman athlete.
When I took a friend to see the Masaccio frescoes, only a limited number of visitors were allowed into the Brancacci Chapel at one time. For some years, it had been closed for restoration. But the flow of admirers is by no means a recent phenomenon. Witness the words of Vasari, written 450 years ago.
Because of Masaccio's work, the Brancacci Chapel has been visited from that time to this by an endless stream of students and masters.
No further comment needed. And what about that fish that Peter drew out of the lake at Christ's command? H.V. Morton, tireless traveller and investigator of scriptural happenings, explains that the musht, or comb fish, is the characteristic fish of the Lake of Galilee.
In the Lake of Galilee, there's a kind of fish which keeps small objects in appropriate pockets, but the sense of the story goes way beyond this touch of folklore.
Always the scholarly rein on our flights of fancy. A more scientific note comes from Aristotle, who, in his Historia Animalium, written around 344 BC, tells us this.
Flatfish go to sleep in the sand, and they can be distinguished by the outlines of their shapes in the sand, and are caught in this position by being speared with pronged instruments.
I wonder what Peter used.
And many thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for her programme There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
I just called to say how much I care.
Husbands and wives who have successfully overcome a crisis in their own marriage are in the best position to provide help and advice to other couples whose union is heading for the rocks. That's the secret behind the success of a church-sponsored marriage rescue programme.
I just called to say I love you.
In the US, over 40% of marriages end in divorce. That's the depressing reality borne out by the statistics, and it's an indication of the daunting challenges many couples face in trying to keep their marriage afloat in today's secularized and high-pressured society. Successful marriages, however, don't work on autopilot, at least not for long. They need care and nurturing, and it's especially vital that the spouses keep the lines of communication open between the two of them. How many husbands or wives argue frequently or feel frustrated, hurt, or angry with their spouse? It's in situations like this that all too many couples believe that the only solution is to go down the path towards separation and divorce. But if married couples in crisis know where to look, help is at hand, and that help can often save a marriage. Originating in Canada, Retrovie is a program offered by Catholic couples and a priest to couples with marriage problems. Thousands of couples headed for cold, unloving relationships or divorce have successfully overcome their marital problems by attending a Retrovie program held in various countries throughout the world. Frank and Julie Laboda and Father Watt Bracken are American, and all three of them are volunteer international coordinators for Retrovie. Frank and Julie are married with four children and live in Madison, Wisconsin. They were pointed in the direction of Retrovie at a time when their own marriage was on the rocks and they were on the brink of divorce. They spoke to me about some of the reasons why their marriage was failing and how attending a Retrovie program helped to renew and heal it.
We had several problems, basically a severe miscommunication and working opposite schedules.
So the communication issues led to us living quite separate lives. And as we worked different shifts in our work schedule, she was working days and I was working nights. And I began an affair with a woman I worked with and spent 9 months in an extramarital affair with a woman from work. Our marriage obviously went further downhill after that, and we were separated twice and 5 weeks away from our final divorce when we found Retrovie.
And how did you find it?
My mother-in-law, Julie's mother, gave her an article from a magazine in the States about the program, and I called right away and registered us for the weekend experience.
And was it really quite dramatic, the turnaround?
It was extremely dramatic for me, but I still had a lot of fear and panic and trust issues. But it gave us hope because the couples that presented the weekend, the couples on the team, had been through misery even worse than ours. And we thought, if they can make it, maybe there's some hope for us too. And it was very grace-filled. You could feel the presence of God. And the team priest was there as well. And we wondered what the priest would have to say about marriage. But it was very grace-filled, and I was overcome with the hope that they offered.
And weren't the majority of the people on this program Catholic? Because you say you're open to all religions or none, or those who have none.
Yes, I think on our weekend, a great majority of them were. But you're right that couples that come to Retrovie come with all different types of faith or no faith whatsoever.
Now, the
program consists, I gather, of a weekend experience, and then this is followed up with 6 to 12 week post-weekend sessions over a period of 3 months. Did you already find after that first weekend that you were discovering where things were going wrong or where to pick up the pieces, or was it more of a question of learning to trust?
I think I knew where things were going wrong before, but I was always pointing a finger of blame at Frank. So the weekend helped me realize what role I played in the deterioration of our marriage. And then the follow-up sessions were integral in change because the post-sessions offered a chance to look more deeply at specific issues like trust, conflict, sex, forgiveness. And so that was really where the bulk of the change occurred throughout the post sessions as well.
I think for me, the weekend showed me what could be right about our relationship again and reminded me of the reasons that I fell in love with Julie in the first place and why we were together from the start of our relationship, rather than showing me what had been wrong, because you could see that in our behavior with one another on a daily basis. But being able to talk with Julie and communicate with her on a whole different level over the course of that weekend and then the post sessions really showed me what was right about our relationship again.
Is it a prerequisite that for people who go to Retrouvai that both couples want to save their marriage? Because presumably if somebody's already given up on it, then it's hopeless.
Well, in our case, Julie had given up. This was her way of checking this one last thing off of her list of things to do before the divorce was final. So no, I don't think that both couples have to be committed to saving their relationship. As long as they're committed to spending the time on the weekend together, it could change their relationship just by being there together.
Each couple is asked to participate fully in the entire weekend and the follow-up sessions. But we would be lying if everyone who came said, yes, I'm 100% committed to making this marriage work. But over the course of the weekend, most of them change their minds and decide, yes, this is worth saving.
Father Watt Bracken is a Catholic priest from Chicago. And along with Frank and Julie, he gave his viewpoint about the strengths of the Retrouvai program.
Before I go into what happens on the weekend, I think what is key, and Frank and Julie have already mentioned this, is the hope that is given on the weekend. The couples come there with a sense of hopelessness with regard to their own relationship. By listening to the stories of other couples, they recognize the fact that other people can go through difficulties as well and come out of those difficulties on the other side with a great deal of hope for their relationship. I think that is the beauty of a peer ministry. Peer ministry allows couples to tell their story of their misery, their story of their hopelessness, and how they moved to a sense of hope. And this is done simply on the weekend by 3 different couples and a priest giving a series of presentations. And the idea is that the couple gives a presentation with a priest. After that, the couples who are participating in the weekend are given a question to reflect. They do some writing, they come together, and then they share with regard to this. And through these series of presentations during the course of the weekend, couples are able to communicate with themselves much more deeply. What we tell the couples on a Friday night is we are not there to solve their problems or to work on their problems. What we do is work on their communication so that once they begin to relate to each other and to communicate to each other, then they begin to solve their own problems on how they choose to solve them.
Now, I don't know whether you keep statistics, but do you happen to know roughly what percentage of the couples who come to Retrouvai do manage to save their marriage? If you have any idea at all on how successful this program is?
We've seen somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80% of marriages at least continue on. Successful marriages, probably half. But they stay in their relationship up to 80% of the time.
That's quite a high percentage.
It's a very high percentage. And it's an experience that we see over and over on the weekend from Friday night to Sunday.
I just call to say I love you.
But what real-life anecdotes do they have of couples attending the Retrouvai program whose marriage seemed doomed to collapse.
I can give you a story about a couple that we know. They were having difficulty. Of course, that's why they were on the weekend originally. They would do well after one presentation in their dialogue, and then they'd go back after another presentation, and they would find themselves arguing again. So on Saturday night, after the first presentation, they seemed to be doing well. After the second presentation, they started an argument, and they figured that it was no use. So they packed their bags, and they decided to leave the retreat house. Well, as happened, as they were driving out of the retreat grounds, there was a chain across the gate of the retreat house. And so there was no way that they could leave the grounds. So they turned around, they unpacked their bags, brought them back in to the retreat house. And long story short, I think this is God's sense of humor by having that chain across the gate, because this couple then continued to work on their relationship, not only on that weekend, but they themselves became very involved with Retrovi after this, to the point where they have given a good number of weekends themselves and a good number of presentations to help heal other marriages.
Do you know of any other particular anecdotes that stick in your mind?
Several, including us, but another couple that when we were presenting team on a weekend, this couple too was up and down and finally got in a huge argument and decided to drive home, and they had about an hour drive. They got about 10 minutes from home and decided it would be harder to tell their kids that they gave up than it would be to turn around with their heads hanging and walk back in the door of Retrovi. So they turned their car around and they came back and finished the weekend and completed all of the follow-up sessions.
And as far as you know, they're still
and
together?
And as far as we know, they're still together and doing well.
Now, coming back, perhaps, shall we say, to the general state of marriage in society today, as you all know, particularly in Western countries, the rate of divorce is incredibly high. Why is that? Why do people give up so quickly, do you think? What more could the church and other bodies be doing to try to bring down that rate of divorce, of separation between couples?
It has a lot to do with the family. John Paul the Great was right when he said, as the family goes, so goes the world. And so Retrovi in the church, I think, is certainly moving in the right direction to curb the divorce rate.
I just think it's so hard, especially in Western countries. We're so bent on instant gratification. And if it's not what I want, I'm going to take it back or return it because it doesn't fit right. And that's carried right over into our relationships. It's not making me happy, so I'm going to return it and start over. And it's greener grass on the other side of the fence. And in most cases, in mine for sure, you know, in being involved in a 9-month relationship with another woman, it's no different. The problems are the same. You carry the problems with you wherever you go. So you can choose to stay in the relationship you started with and fight for your marriage and work on change in your own personal life and in your relationship, or you can continue to throw them away and start with a new one. And especially in the United States, we're at the point where our society says it's just easier to toss it aside.
That was Frank Laboda, and you also heard the voice of his wife, Julie, and of Father Watt Bracken, speaking about the marriage rescue program called Retrovi.
I love you, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart.
And that's all we have time for on today's program. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.